Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, clinical sexologist, with Xander Keg, licensed social worker. We have a panel of experts this hour. And Xander, I will turn this over to you to do the introductions.
This is our second episode of a two-part series. We're talking with Dr. Jameson Green and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper and Dr. Erica Anderson. We're going to be talking about some more advanced topics. We're going to be talking about informed consent. What is that? What does that mean? And why is that important? And how is it being used or utilized within this area of trans healthcare or gender-affirming care? We're going to talk about evidence-based care. What does that mean? How is that defined? How is it established? What's the criteria for that? Is gender-affirming care evidence-based? And we're going to also be talking about the claims that are made that the deprivation of gender-affirming care, especially for minors, is akin to claims are made that suicide is a likely outcome, or at least an attempt of suicide by a young person who is denied access to gender-affirming care. So we're going to talk about that because there was a study that came out recently from Finland. Let's start with informed consent. And I'm wondering, James, if you'd like to start us off, because you do have your PhD in law and policy, and informed consent is a legal process, although there's medical language as well, and you typically sign informed consent documents in lots of other places that aren't medical offices. But if you could give us a bird's eye view of what is this thing called informed consent?
It's a requirement that in order to undergo treatment, the provider of that treatment must explain to you what are the risks and benefits. And when you have a conversation, and usually there's a document that summarizes the issues, and you are given an opportunity to ask questions, have the provider answer your questions, assuming then that you are satisfied with those answers, and that when you sign the informed consent, that you understand what has been explained to you, that you feel that you understand the risks and the benefits of whatever procedure it is, and you agree to undergo that procedure. Sometimes, depending on the institution or organization through which that informed consent is being proffered, you were also signing an agreement not to sue them in case anything goes wrong. So that's why it's important to read the documents carefully. And often these are very pro forma procedures. If you're in a hospital, for example, and you're about to undergo an emergency appendectomy, you will sign an informed consent and you may be under duress, actually, but still you're expected to sign it, or someone who's authorized for you or by you to sign for something, to make that agreement on your behalf, will sign the informed consent. And then that goes into the record.
It's quite sophisticated language. If it's true that the average reader, at least in the United States, is reading at the sixth to eighth grade level, are they able to comprehend, right? And so you're talking about the explanation of the risks and benefits that would be coming from the provider. I honestly don't recall getting a good long risk and benefits discussion, having that with my endocrinologist or my surgeons. I think they did expect that I was knowledgeable enough. And thankfully, I think I was knowledgeable enough. It sounds like, one, it's probably a requirement.
Yes.
Right? I'm sure insurance companies require it, employers require this. Erica or Laura, you're a therapist and you have an informed consent form as well. What are some of the issues that you've heard, or what are some of the issues you've had with gaining access to informed consent clinics for the purpose of accessing gender-affirming care?
I'd like to say a couple things. A lot of people think of informed consent as simply signing the form. And I think from a larger perspective, that's not really a helpful way to understand informed consent. Listening carefully to what Jameson said, it's really a process. It's a process of education and communication between the provider and the patient. So that process really needs to be deliberate and do all the things you would want to achieve the outcome, which is for a patient to really understand what they're submitting to. In a previous lifetime, almost years ago, I was an examiner for district court for involuntary confinement for psychiatric reasons or people who had substance abuse problems. if we think about informed consent, it really is predicated on competency. And I think for the vast majority of people, it's really not a question. You know, people are competent. But when you get into the area of healthcare, where there are some pretty sophisticated things that go on that are beyond the grasp of the average layperson, and then you add to that perhaps the fact that people are not as mature or intellectually competent when they're younger, and it's not necessarily a problem, it's just a developmental process. So we have to ask ourselves, well, what do we think about competency of minors? It's not a discrete yes or no competency or not, but really rather an evolution of levels of competency. So that's when I think it gets to be a problem. I have opined that reaching the age of majority chronologically doesn't constitute achieving competency 100%, and that prior to achieving age 18 in the United States, you're not competent, that there's a gradation of awareness of intellectual capability that continues beyond 18, and arguably the neuroscientists say it's into the 20s. So we have this complicated mixture of a couple of issues. And when we're talking about decisions about minors, we have, of course, historically required parents or the guardians, legal guardians, to make decisions on behalf of minors. But some would say, well, teenagers who are gender variant or gender questioning know their own minds. They should be treated as same as adults. Personally, I don't think that way, but a lot of these issues that I think are relevant in terms of how do we evaluate informed consent? And one of the issues that Laura and I run into all the time is teenagers who say, oh, well, mom and dad aren't going to consent to medical interventions for gender. I'll just wait till I'm 18 and I'll walk down the street and go to the Planned Parenthood. They use the informed consent model, and anybody who's 18 can literally walk in there and get hormones. And that's actually true.
American Medical Association is the one who initially came up with the informed consent for the national body. And it really wasn't meant to end up the way it is today. It was supposed to provide an opportunity for the patient or client to be able to ask questions regarding sure. medical or surgical procedures. And we've moved completely away from that.
In the United States, in general, 18 is the age of majority. But when it comes to medical care, it varies by state. So in the state of Oregon, you can receive gender-affirming medical care at age 15 without parental consent. This had never really been an issue that I was concerned about until recently, because the WPATH standards of care are very clear that parents should be involved in the process and weigh in and basically give consent as well, unless it's a case where that could cause harm to the child. But I've had several families more recently who are in a situation in the state of Oregon where the 15-year-old or 14-and-a-half-year-old is moving forward with medical intervention, even when the parents do not feel that it's the best thing for them at that particular point in time. The whole issue of being able to provide informed consent, the developmental lens that I think is so critical that we look through in determining one's ability to give informed consent is something that I think this field, the gender medicine field, is really struggling with. I think that there's very different opinions, as Erica said. This is a topic that I talk about frequently. And just from my perspective, approaching the work with adults is very different than approaching it with adolescents in terms of things like their ability to give consent. It's one of the reasons that I believe so strongly that a more thorough assessment process is really critical, especially for minors, because from my perspective, that's the process, like the process of helping the family and the child understand, like, what are all of the complicating factors for your particular situation, and providing that information to them as they make the decision about how to move forward with interventions really allows them to give informed consent in the most thorough way possible. And then we haven't even touched on puberty blockers with much younger adolescents, and does require the parents' involvement.
Before we get deep into the treatment of adolescents and children, I want to say that in the context of, for lack of a better term, gender-affirming care, the informed consent model arose as a direct result of standards of care requirements that insisted that people get some therapy. And the informed consent model was designed for this patient population, was intended to bring adults into medical care who were living on the street who were disadvantaged economically and who could not afford to get any kind of mental health assistance. But they were getting street hormones. They were getting hormones illegally, and they were not getting follow-up medical care and things like that. So the informed consent model was first applied to adults and basically was intended to bring people into medical care, into settings where they could get ongoing medical care, like the federally qualified health centers, such as Callan Lord and Whitman Walker and Fenway Health, to bring in that population that was medically underserved. And they could get their hormones reliably, and they could begin to start getting primary health care. It's not about their gender at all. It's about their human well-being. So that when I think when Planned Parenthood stepped in and started applying that model and opening it up to younger people, mostly college students, I think, that's when it began to get muddy. And the informed consent was not about surgery. It was strictly about the ability to access medical care and get your hormones provided by a medical provider and to keep you in a care system so that you weren't floundering around. You could be medically monitored. It's a totally different situation. And I think we've gone off the deep end with respect to saying that because of these informed consent clinics, everybody's getting access to care on demand. And that's not what Laura's doing, and Erica too, to make people aware of and follow closely what it is that they're actually doing to their bodies and what this is going to mean down the road. When you talk about younger people who are just starting, that's a totally different setting than what we were talking about originally, which is adults and marginalized, highly marginalized people.
Well, in some ways, what you're describing as the initial reason for this idea of an informed consent model for trans care or medical care for trans people so that they're not getting illicit or unregulated hormones from the street.
Yeah, these are people outside of the healthcare system. They don't have any access to the free care that they can trust understands them as a trans person.
To me, that still sounds like a harm reduction model, which comes from
exactly.
Substance use community, right? Where it's like, we don't want people to overdose on drugs, so we're going to give them in a safe place to use them in a safe dosage and clean needles. Because there's a medical process or procedure or treatment occurring, an informed consent document needs to be reviewed and signed. So it became known as the informed consent model when it's really a harm reduction model with an informed consent form.
That is exactly right. That is how it originated in this context. Yeah,
right.
Nothing to do with trying to capture children.
I think what people are running into is the inconsistent treatment models. I talk to families pretty regularly, and my kid went to a multidisciplinary clinic at a children's hospital. Once they turn 18, they can just walk into a Planned Parenthood, and in some places at 16 at a Planned Parenthood and just get hormones. But they don't know about that. So they're just like, that doesn't happen. Well, thankfully, it didn't happen for your child, but it's happening for other people's children. And so this lack of the knowledge of the difference between the multidisciplinary clinics and the WPATH standards of care that are being applied or in those clinics versus the others.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our three panelists, Dr. Erica Anderson, Dr. Jameson Green, and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our panel of experts, Dr. Erica Anderson, Dr. Jameson Green, and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. Let's pick up where we left off.
It's so fascinating, though. I'd love to hear the history. You've been involved for so many years in WPATH, Jameson, and so you have this long history.
In and out of WPATH.
Anything else about informed consent? Was there any last words about informed consent?
We are such an individualistic society, and we place such great premium upon individual rights that is not the same as all societies. So as an example, in Sweden, it's illegal to be homeless, not because they want to deprive people of their individual liberties, but because they think it's inhumane for somebody to live unsheltered for their safety and well-being. And that's a more collectivist society, of course, than the US. It's just mind-boggling to me because I go to Sweden often and they say, how come you have this homeless problem? What's the deal? You know, you're the richest country in the world. Can't you find a way to keep people in a place where they're safe? And it's just a complete different mindset. And I do think we're hyper-vigilant about individual rights. I think it's true in lots of other venues where there's controversy like gun control and free speech and so on. That's another contextual thing that I never forget is people are hyper-vigilant about, you know, I need to be able to decide no matter what anybody else says, no matter what the contingencies might be.
Well, that reminds me of having a conversation with somebody recently about puberty blockers, if taken prior to Tanner stage two, especially in natal males, will sterilize them. So this idea of going on puberty blockers at a really young age comes from the Netherlands. And back in those days, sterilization was a requirement for transition anyway. So nobody was really concerned about sterility or lack of fertility because it was already a mandated portion of transition anyway. You're going to be sterilized before you can officially change everything over to the other sex.
That was particularly true in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And many countries in Western Europe still have such laws. Sweden changed their laws effective early 2015 until 2014. They had such laws, and some of the doctors still practicing in Sweden discourage trans people from having children because it's a holdover also from eugenics. It's a very complicated situation, but I think that's one of the reasons it's such a flashpoint for society is people are thinking, oh my God, we're sterilizing children. And I would guess most people don't want to sterilize children. I mean, not a popular thing to do. And so that's how it's discussed in this like hyperbolic way.
What does it mean that a type of treatment, whether it's psychological or medical, what makes something evidence-based? How's that determined? Part of that question would be, well, what's the issue? Because we're hearing oftentimes that gender-affirming care is evidence-based, it's life-saving, it's medically necessary. These are the types of concepts that are intertwined. So what does it mean to be evidence-based? Who'd like to take that question? And is gender-affirming care evidence-based? Yeah, James.
So in the standards of care, Appendix version 8, Appendix A, which describes the methodology for the standards, for this edition of the standards, they say, this version of the standards of care, SOC 8, is based upon a more rigorous and methodological evidence-based approach than previous versions. This evidence is not only based on the published literature, direct as well as background evidence, but also on consensus-based expert opinion. Evidence-based guidelines include recommendations intended to optimize patient care and are informed by a systematic review of evidence and an assessment of the benefits and harms of alternative care options. Evidence-based research provides the basis for sound clinical practice guidelines and recommendations, but must be balanced by the realities and feasibility of providing care in diverse settings. The process for development of the SOC 8 incorporated recommendations on clinical practice guideline development from the National Academies of Medicine and the World Health Organization that addressed transparency, the conflict of interest policy, committee composition, and group process.
So the first thing that I think of is that's considered one of the lowest standards for evidence-based in medicine practice. But I think a lot of our care is consensus-based and patient reports.
There are literature reviews based on studies that are methodologically compared, etc. A lot of information is taken into account. It's not just opinion, and it's not just based on personal practice opinions.
Yes.
It's based on a lot of discussions where you can say, look, this is my experience in my clinic. I hear that your experience in your clinic is different. How can we come to a consensus around what might be a best practice? And it's not just two people doing it. It's a laudable.
I've been going to school on this, even though I thought I was an evidence-based clinical psychologist, but I've been going to school on this for the last couple of years and going to some meetings, which Laura's been present at as well. And some of the leaders in the world who are now used as experts on methodology to derive best practices, guidelines from evidence reviews are teaching a method that is being applied in many, many venues, including in the countries in Europe that have conducted what are called systematic evidence reviews. There's a rigorous methodology. Its principal locus right now comes from McMaster University in Canada, where they are using this technology. And it's pretty impressive. The Swedish systematic evidence review, for example, started with 10,000 pieces of scientific literature research publications and ended up winnowing them down based on the criteria of the review to a smaller number. It was 100 and some, and then down to 27 that meet the most rigorous standards for evaluation. And this is now transgender care for youth. And as a result of their evidence review, they did a pivot. As people know, they did a major pivot. Their evidence review article has been published last year in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. And as a result of their systematic evidence review, they became far more cautious. Unlike some hyperbolic reports of it, they didn't eliminate gender care for youth or even medicines for youth, but they did put some restrictions on it because their overall conclusion was that the evidence supporting puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones for minors was weak or very weak. And that's been replicated in the other countries where they have had similar systematic evidence reviews. I'm in communication, as maybe I said last time, with Hilary Cass and the Cass Commission in the UK. They've done multiple systematic evidence reviews in specialty areas. Now, this is very particular to youth care, as I'm conceding. And one of the things that does appear in the adolescent chapter in the Standards of Care 8 is an acknowledgement or a statement to the effect that a systematic evidence review wasn't possible. And it's a little bit cringeworthy for me, you know, when I read that, because as Laura and I know, there are such reviews that are going on in these various countries, and they are reaching the conclusion that the rapid medicalization of gender variant youth probably is not warranted based on the current evidence.
Erica, I share that feeling of concern about just how the WPATH process worked versus how these more rigorous systematic reviews have been going forward. And it is concerning. We were told that there weren't enough articles to do a systematic review when we started working on version 8 of the standards of care for WPATH. And so there was a process.
It was a long time ago.
And it was a long time ago. It took many years to get that finished, but we were adding articles all the time. And I don't know what the number of articles could have been used when we started versus what's being looked at now, how different it was, but there was no rating of articles in terms of methodological rigor or anything like that. We looked at the research that was available, but it was largely consensus based on this expert experience and the Dutch protocol. And we rely heavily on, or the Dutch research, which has some limitations, certainly can't be applied to our current cohort of adolescent gender diverse youth. It's a very, very different population. And so to base everything on one study, one cohort of kids that was from many years ago, is kind of risky. I value that research greatly, but we just have to understand that in some ways it's apples and oranges in terms of the kids that we're working with these days.
I've encountered people who they behave in a fairly hostile or dismissive way when this topic comes up around the systematic reviews and the findings of those reviews, and then the changes that are made at those higher levels, at those governmental, the national levels in those European and Scandinavian countries. There's total non-recognition. It doesn't exist, or so what, or well, it's being led by a really conservative government in Sweden. You know, it doesn't even make sense. Just a couple of years ago, everybody was saying that Sweden and places like it were these wonderful utopian socialist places to go live. I find it really interesting that if there is evidence and you can do a robust review and countries are doing it, Florida did it, think we're the only state so far that's done it. They've all come to the same conclusion. I wonder, it's not rhetorical, but I know that it might sound like it. Why do you think it's resulting in such hostile response or total rejection from primarily, I'd say, the US and Canada? When I say, well, have you read the Swedish study or heard about it or the CAST report in Britain? They just dismiss it. They say, no, I haven't read it. I'm not going to read it. They think it's illegitimate.
Well, if somebody's saying we're shutting this down, well, then I disagree, regardless of what their rationale is. They just disagree. The fact is, too, though, there are corporations that do these systematic reviews and are paid to do them. They get paid a lot of money to do them by organizations like governmental bodies. And they say, what are you looking for? And they basically will do the review and tell you what you want to hear. That has actually happened historically with respect to adult transgender healthcare. That influenced our insurance industry in the United States for many, many years. There are agendas that happen.
Yeah.
And I think we have to look at these studies very, very carefully and not just dismiss them because we disagree with somebody's interpretation of the conclusion. This is a complex subject.
Yeah, very. Jameson, arguably you're the one who has the longevity more than me, but I've been trans for a long time in America. And during that entire time, I've been a psychologist. And I've been paying attention to what's been going on. And there is in the trans community, I will say it this way, a residue, an accumulation of trauma that results in many, many trans-identified people having a strong reaction to anything that smacks of a restriction to access to care and needed medical care. We run smack against that when we try to talk about what do we know and what do we not know. And certainly, as Jameson would probably say, years ago, we didn't have a lot of scientific evidence of what care should be for trans people. But some pioneers went about it in the best way they could based on what they did know, aware that they didn't know everything. And we've gotten ourselves to this point, which is a far better place than it was 30, 35 years ago.
Especially for adults.
Especially for adults.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kagg. Our panelists are Dr. Erica Anderson, Dr. Jameson Green, and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. We will be taking our second commercial break. We will be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kagg. We have experts this hour, Dr. Erica Anderson, Dr. Jameson Green, and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. Let's play a little bit of where we left off.
We say years ago, we didn't have a lot of scientific evidence of what care should be for trans people, but some pioneers went about it in the best way they could based on what they did know, aware that they didn't know everything. And we've gotten ourselves to this point, which is a far better place than it was 30, 35 years ago.
Especially for adults.
Especially for adults. And so in these discussions, often there's no nuance like we're having, I think, here today, where we're saying, okay, well, let's just talk about all of what's important and try to figure it out. I think I know personally some of the people who've done evidence reviews in Europe, and it's very important to them that they give care to trans people and be compassionate. Michael Landian, one of the principal authors of the Swedish report, for example, is a psychiatrist who's been caring for trans patients for 25 years. And Sweden is a society very well known to be a progressive and compassionate society. I have a strong reaction when people reject out of hand what has gone on in Europe. Some of our colleagues have said, oh, well, you know, we don't have to pay attention to Europe.
Very American perspective.
Very.
Even the judiciary agrees with sometimes.
American exceptionalism is alive and well everywhere in America. And I just can't believe that in the 21st century, people say things like that. Were you taught critical thinking when you were,
No,
student?
No, not in this country.
Sorry, I went on and on.
No, I love that. That's probably part of the issue, is that I don't think there's a lot of critical thinking being taught in school. I don't. Anything else you want to say about this concept of evidence-based before we move on?
I'd like to say one more thing about evidence that gets thrown around in the debates about trans care. When you say something has very low quality evidence, that does not necessarily mean it's not an effective treatment. And it also does not necessarily mean that, compared to all the other medical treatments that you can get, that it is any better or worse than the quality of evidence that supports any medical care. Most medical care is not delivered under a standard that is gold star level. There is not a definitive, best in class way of doing almost anything medically.
Yeah.
Ask physicians and surgeons about the medications they provide. They're constantly providing medications off label for hundreds of medical treatments having nothing to do with gender issues that everybody takes for granted and agrees with and accepts as normal.
Mm.
The fact that we now apply these standards in this particular instance is irrational.
I agree with Jameson. I think, though, that what we have to understand is when we come to the gender youth care issues, it's because minors and children are involved that sort of inflames the fear on the part of people. I understand that John Kennedy, the senator from Louisiana, made a speech in the Senate, on the floor of the Senate today, decrying gender-affirming care. And of course, as you all know, I still provide it. As far as I'm concerned, I'm providing gender-affirming care. Everybody's got an opinion because they were a child, so they have an opinion about children. There's a lot of nuance to this. I remember when some of the debates were going on in state legislatures, and I heard reports, maybe Jameson, you did a lot as well, but that legislators wouldn't even talk to people. They didn't want to talk to trans people. They didn't want to talk to parents of trans kids. They didn't want to talk to professionals who treated trans people. What kind of society is this? Not the one I want. Where
it's not evidence-based legislation.
Exactly.
In my mind, what's so important to pay attention to and how to incorporate the reality that the evidence is low and we don't have strong evidence for this care, from my perspective, as Erica said, and Jameson too, doesn't mean that we shouldn't provide the care. But I do think it means a couple of things. I think that it means that, especially when we're talking about children, we need to make sure we're not cutting corners. If we don't have good evidence, we need to be as thorough as we can be and follow the standards of care as closely as possible. Every child deserves that. So that's one thing I think is absolutely critical. It concerns me greatly when I see that that's not always happening. Secondly, I think that it's super important in the informed consent process for the young person and the parents to be told that the evidence is not great. There's a lot we don't know. There are risks because we don't have good research longitudinally. And so parents just need to be aware of that when they're making the decision, and the teenager needs to be aware to the best of their ability that we're not saying, no, this isn't going to necessarily help you, but you just need to know going into it that there's a lot we don't know. We don't have great evidence to suggest that the outcomes are always good, and you just need to take that into consideration.
Thanks for that. Two quick things before we move on. It was helpful for me to hear, James, two things that you said. It puts it into perspective for me where some of the tension or debate is coming from, because it sounds like on one side, coming mostly from maybe from the trans community, is this memory of an agenda-driven care system. And so we're leery and apprehensive and suspicious. There can be a tendency towards that. And on the other side, there can be an over scrutinization of holding us to a higher level of evidence base than another area of medicine. Those competing forces, which are based in actualities that have happened and how they influence how people are responding or reacting to what's going on now. It was helpful for me to hear that. When we talk about what is evidence-based or looking at evidence, there was a study that came out of Finland recently that was looking at the difference between those who were receiving gender-affirming care. I think it was people who were on the cross-sex hormones or gender-affirming hormones versus the ones who weren't, maybe a teenage population or cohort across the country, and looking at suicide I don't know the details of it. Is it true what they claim, that denial of gender-affirming care leads to higher levels of suicide in that population?
The primary thing that I took away from it was that what they found was that it's really the psychiatric problems that are driving the suicidality, which is no surprise to me. This is what I've suspected for some time. In other words, the gender-affirming care didn't take away the suicidal ideations or attempts of the young people in the study, which is a talking point you often hear, especially in the United States, that if we deny people this care, that in and of itself is going to cause someone to commit suicide. And no doubt about it, for many people, not accessing the care can cause more distress and increase their dysphoria, which can lead to more depression. And that can lead to all kinds of problems, including feeling suicidal. But what they found was that it was the underlying psychiatric issues that the people had that was really the driving factor for the suicidality. I think what we should take from that really is that individuals going through this process, when we do an assessment and take the time to really understand for that person what's going on, often have significant mental health issues, and those need to be dealt with. We need to not ignore the mental health issues, which unfortunately often happens. I think the biggest problem I see is where providers believe that if they just treat the gender issue with hormones and surgeries, then the mental health issues will improve. And then when the mental health issues don't improve, that can sometimes make the person feel even worse because they had all their eggs in that basket thinking that that was going to be the answer. So the safest way from my perspective is to address the mental health issues as best as you can prior to then reassess the dysphoria, see where the person's at, and then decide about medical interventions for the gender dysphoria.
We'd have a couple minutes left. Erica, is there something you'd like to say?
I tried to say something clever and it landed badly because I was on mute. I just want to say amen to what Laura said. I totally agree with her. She and I collaborate very closely, as most of you know, and have been concerned about these things. And are we concerned about suicidality among young people? Absolutely. Do we feel like individualized evaluation is necessary? Absolutely. Do we think that the solution to suicidality in every case is a gender transition? No. In fact, here's a little preview. I was privileged to see the draft final CAS commission report, and a lot of people are going to be surprised by the serious work that they did on this very issue. They did their own systematic evidence review, and it's concordant with the findings in Finland.
I can tell you just really quickly that I remember before I started my transition that I heard from several adult trans people that if I wasn't driven to transition, if I don't transition, I'll kill myself, that I wasn't really trans. I heard that message directly between the years of 2000 and 2005 when I was contemplating starting transition. And I thought, oh, I guess I'm not trans. It was one of the reasons I didn't start transition, because I wasn't suicidal. So it was something that was going around. But it's been a wonderful conversation because we've gone through and we talked really seriously about some important topics. And I hope that there's a lot of lessons that people can take away from this. I know I have. So I appreciate you coming back on and talking to us about these really important issues, James and Laura and Erica. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good day.
You have been listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kegg. And our panelists this hour were experts Dr. Erica Anderson, Dr. Jameson Green, and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. Stay tuned for our next show, and thank you for listening.